As I mentioned, really these last two classes on Sunday and then today, they form a little bit of an epilogue to what goes on in Romans. Romans, the book, the letter, is written roughly about 57 AD. It's probably one of the last letters that Paul wrote before what are sometimes known as the prison epistles. So Ephesians, Colossians, Philippians, and then pretty much everything after Romans. If assuming a traditional chronology, so sometimes I don't want to get too deep into the weeds on this. We really can't be 100% sure when many of the letters are written, and even like say Ephesians, Colossians, or Philippians, where we know he was in prison, we can't definitively 100% say that it was in that Roman imprisonment. But traditionally that's been accepted. I think there's a lot of good evidence in that line. And assuming that, really after the letter to the Romans in around 57 AD, as he's preparing to go to Jerusalem, and then from there to Rome, any letter after Romans is going to be from his time in prison in Rome or after that. So again, Ephesians, Colossians, Philippians, and then the letters to 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus. Although 1 Timothy and Titus, he probably wasn't in prison at that point, but they're still after this point. So Romans, I mean, it sounds like it's one of the latest letters written. It's actually kind of like the midpoint of his letters. They come in these clumps. But in the book of Romans, we learn at the very end, toward chapter 16, part of the reason that he wrote it was because he intends to come to Rome. And here in Acts, we see how that trip goes. Paul in Romans, he had asked for their prayers. He knew that some people were going to be out for his neck when he went to Jerusalem. He asked for their prayers. And that's kind of the funny way that God works. I mean, I guess from a very pessimistic point of view, or if Paul was just pessimist himself, he could have said, well, thanks a lot for the prayers. You must not have been praying, or I guess they just weren't answered, because he gets put in prison. Which you would think that's not really this God can't be answering prayers if the thing that we're praying for, I get in prison from this. But from that, I think Paul recognizes, and he says so in some of his later letters that we'll get to today, that God works in these ways sometimes. Sometimes, we might pray for something not to happen, and what God let's happen is the thing that we prayed for not to happen. But then we see that God carries us through that, and also that God uses that to the benefit of other people. In the same way, his imprisonment and his trek to Rome in chains is going to work out in that regard. So let's read Acts chapter 28. We'll read it in pieces, take it in chunks. And then before we close, we'll make a few final points and just reference some other scriptures that come into play in relation to this. So Acts chapter 28, and as we begin, let me show you where we are in here. He came to Jerusalem.
You don't have that on.
All right, thank you very much. That's because that is not on. And I can draw this right now. Let's take us from here to here. It should be on in a second. So that's pretty much Paul's journey, roughly, by ship. He starts out in Jerusalem. And actually, I don't think he goes in ship by ship to Caesarea, but he goes from Jerusalem to Caesarea, and then from there, he goes on a ship all the way across this way. It's right there where that big X blob is that he runs into the storm. And it's there that we're going to start out in Acts chapter 28. From there, actually, really where we're going to start out is right about here is a small island of Malta. Ultimately, from there, actually, I think it actually does show on here. I believe this island right here would be Malta. And so that island right there should be Malta. From there, ultimately in this chapter, he's going to come up this way to the western shore of Italy. And then from there, he's going to head into Rome, which I think is right about there. So that's roughly the journey that we're tracing today. And right now, we're just a little bit west of that blob where that big circle is in Malta. So Acts chapter 28, I'm going to read the first 10 verses. After we were brought safely through, we then learned that the island was called Malta. The native people showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and welcomed us all, because it had begun to rain and was cold. When Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and put them on the fire, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. When the native people saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, "No doubt this man is a murderer. Though he has escaped from the sea, justice has not allowed him to live." He, however, shook off the creature into the fire and suffered no harm. They were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and said that he was a god. Now in the neighborhood of that place were lands belonging to the chief man of the island, named Publius, who received us and entertained us hospitably for 3 days. It happened that the father of Publius lay sick with fever and dysentery. And Paul visited him and prayed, and putting his hands on him, healed him. And when this had taken place, the rest of the people on the island who had diseases also came and were cured. They also honored us greatly, and when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. So here in Malta, I always remember this. Stuart probably knows this person. Rachel, if she were in here, she knows him as well. At Sci Fair, we have a member there from Malta. Steve, you know Steve? Yeah. So Steve. So if he's ever in Acts, I mean, he'll tell you just a little bit about Malta. But he's from Malta. His wife is from Spain. He says, funny thing, they don't have snakes there anymore. Obviously, they had snakes at one time. They don't have snakes there anymore on that island. Things go extinct. Likely, I mean, I read somewhere that this is very possibly just because over time, especially in European countries, just over the long span of time that humans have been there, it becomes deforested over time. That's going to mess up the environments of some of the creatures, including probably snakes. We don't know exactly why they're not there anymore, but they're there in Paul's time. They bite him. Vipers are always the bad kind of snake, the poisonous kind of snake. Vipers are, I believe that rattlesnakes might be a type of viper. I think rattlesnakes are a type of viper and cottonmouths. Any of those ones with those triangular heads, those are vipers. So a viper bites them, and this is kind of how people, it's kind of funny, you see this over and over in the Bible, especially in some of the Acts accounts, people who initially think that these guys are ruffians or are bad in some type of way. They think that Paul must have obviously done something bad if he gets bit by a snake. And then it changes, not just on a dime, but it changes to the opposite extreme of, okay, obviously this guy is a god. It was just kind of a funny way that I guess people tend to act when they're ungrounded in worshiping God or following after the true God. It's either one or the other. They just operate in these types of extremes. Other than that, the people, the Maltese, the people in Malta, they turn out to be pretty hospitable to Paul and the people that are with him. And eventually, Paul, they recognize that he has, whether they attribute it initially to the power of God or not, they realize that something's different about Paul. In those verses 7 through 10, Paul not only heals the father of the chief there, but he heals many of the other people. Other thoughts on this? Carl.
Yeah, I think that's what you see in the Gentile nations and in the Greek and Roman world. That if something bad to you happened to you, it's because of the faiths that they, you know, and so they blame the faiths, for the snake biting Paul, and then clearly Paul must have done something to deserve that. But you know, they also have the idea that the gods do come down and walk among them, and so you have gods and you have demigods, and that's not an uncommon thing, at least in their mind, and it's strange for us because we don't think that way now. We've lived in a world that's been predominantly Christian for 1700 years or so, but it used to be very common for them to think that, and in fact I would imagine in most places, and the only place that they didn't think that way, that kind of thing could happen, was in Israel, and in Judaism. So the only culture that would say no, it's blasphemous to say that God walks among us, or the Son of God is, or the Jews, where it happened.
Go back to the barbarians. This was the status of the barbarians.
Yeah.
Even like Rhode Island, they knew God. They knew of God.
Yeah.
Word spreading somehow or another, those that left Jerusalem on their trips to Rome, since they had no known language, they communicated. And they were fierce warriors. They defended their islands several times. I feel taken by various nations.
One thing that we'll circle back to as we just make some final applications of this, it's really just these 10 verses here. If you remember the end of Mark and the account of the Great Commission that Jesus gives his apostles there, he says that there's going to be signs for those who believe. They'll handle snakes. He says they'll drink poison and not be harmed, which doesn't happen here, but he goes on to talk about that they will heal people. You see that being played out here specifically in Acts 28, especially the snakes and also the other things. Snakes also, all throughout the Bible, that this is not just in Mark, but you remember in the book of Numbers, this is a big thing that happens. And I think incidents like this should remind us of Numbers. I believe it's number 6, I think, or Numbers. I didn't write it down. I think it's number 6 in maybe the first dozen verses or so, number 6 or 9. But in the book of Numbers, you remember that people complain and God sends fiery serpents among them, and they start dying by the bite of these serpents. And then they look on to the staff of that Moses puts out for them in order to be saved. And so protection from snakes and serpents is something that even goes back to the Old Testament. It was something that God promises his people. And even in Psalms like 91, a big psalm of protection, he talks about those who God protects and cares for will be able to tread over adders. If you remember in Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, one of the promises he gives to his people, and especially within a scene of redemption, Isaiah looks forward to a day when a child will be able to stick his hand into the den of a serpent and not be bitten. And just heavily figurative language. And I think this is for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, you see, especially in Numbers, and you see especially here in Acts chapter 28, that we're dealing with real serpents and real vipers. But, of course, also from the very beginning, this isn't lost on anybody that reads the Bible. Satan is depicted in the very beginning as a serpent. And so if God can protect his people from serpents that crawl around on their bellies and bite and envenomate you, then he can protect you from the bigger serpent that prowls and crawls around as well. So let's keep on reading from there, unless you have other comments or points. Let's go to verse 11. After 3 months, we set sail in a ship that had wintered in the island, a ship of Alexandria with the twin gods as a figurehead. Putting in at Syracuse, we stayed there for 3 days, and from there we made a circuit and arrived at Rhegium. And after one day, a south wind sprang up, and on the second day we came to Puteoli. There we found brothers and were invited to stay with them for 7 days. And so we came to Rome. And the brothers there, when they heard about us, came as far as Forum of Appius and 3 taverns to meet us. On seeing them, Paul thanked God and took courage. And when we came into Rome, Paul was allowed to stay by himself with the soldier who guarded him. So really here, we're talking about that last wing just up north from that island of Malta. A few notable things. So this ship, again, I mentioned this last time. Really, they just wait until, I mean, we're talking about the winter here. This is when the heaviest storms were. It talks earlier about it being cold. So we're probably by about February or March is when ships would have started sailing again. That's the season that we're roughly dealing with. Roman soldiers, they didn't really have to have a ship of their own. They could just requisition a ship. No one was going to tell a Roman soldier, no, you can't get on board here. So they wait for a ship, verse 11, that they know is sailing in the direction that they want. It's a ship that it says that it's had the twin gods as a figurehead. It means that it was probably named after those twin gods, just kind of like you have the Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria. You might name ships were commonly named after gods. These particular gods, the twin gods, if you're familiar with Gemini, the constellation Gemini, there's those zodiac signs. Gemini is one of those zodiac signs. It comes from this. In Greek mythology, there were two gods that were twins, Castor and Pollux. And one of them was a deity, or partially a deity, and can never die, and the other one wasn't. And when the one that was mortal died, the one that was a deity promised to share his deity with him and was granted that request. So I think one lives half the year, the other lives the other half of the year. Zeus puts them in the sky as the Gemini constellation. But those are the gods that it's talking about. If you ever hear Gemini, you'll remember, hey, it's one of those things that's actually mentioned in the Bible. It's something that Paul comes across. He rides on a ship named after that to go to Rome. And in Rome, the notable thing, this might be the only reference in the book of Acts to the saints in Rome. Paul writes a letter to the saints in Rome, and it says here in verse 14, there we found brothers and were invited to stay with them 7 days, and so we came to Rome. And the brothers there, verse 15, when they heard about us, came as far as the Forum, and they went to meet them. They met them and they brought them into the city and welcomed them into the city. So again, this is Luke is a different writer than Paul. Paul, when he writes the Romans, obviously he has a specific reason that he's writing. Luke doesn't tell us everything about the church at Rome. And after this, he's mostly going to talk about the Jews there who are not part of the church. But you can imagine that just a small instance. I mean, we see people who would have been well familiar with Paul's letter to them a few years earlier, would have, I assume, been expecting him to come eventually, maybe not in chains, but they're expecting him to come. And they show their hospitality by going out and meeting him and then bringing him into the city. Any thoughts before we just read those last few verses of Acts chapter 28? We'll continue on. Acts 28. Just read verses 17. I'll read through the rest of the chapter, and then we'll make our points about this, and I just move on to some applications for us. After 3 days, he called together the local leaders of the Jews, and when they had gathered, he said to them, "Brothers, though I had done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. When they had examined me, they wished to set me at liberty, because there is no reason for the death penalty in my case. But because the Jews objected, I was compelled to appeal to Caesar, though I had no charge to bring against my nation. For this reason, therefore, I have asked to see you and speak with you, since it is because of the hope of Israel that I am wearing this chain. And they said to him, we have received no letters from Judea about you, and none of the brothers coming here has reported or spoken any evil about you. But we desire to hear from you that what your views are. For with regard to this sect, we know that everywhere it is spoken against. When they had appointed a day for him, they came to him at his lodging in great numbers. From morning till evening, he expounded to them, testifying to the kingdom of God and trying to convince them about Jesus, both from the law of Moses and from the prophets. And some were convinced by what he said, but others disbelieved. And disagreeing among themselves, they departed after Paul had made one statement. The Holy Spirit was right in saying to your fathers through Isaiah the prophet, go to this people and say, you will indeed hear, but never understand, and you will indeed see, but never perceive. For this people's heart has grown dull, and with their ears they can barely hear, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and turn, and I would heal them. Therefore, let it be known to you that the salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles. They will listen. He lived there 2 whole years at his own expense and welcomed all who came to him, proclaiming the kingdom of God and teaching about the Lord Jesus Christ with all boldness and without hindrance. And there is exactly where the book of Acts ends. I imagine that Luke knew what happened after this point. I imagine that there's no way to prove this, and this could be wrong as well, but I imagine that Luke is not writing this just right after verse 31. In other words, I don't think that he waited just to this point and then I can't go on any longer. That's it. I guess it could have been that way. I'm not saying that he wrote it 10 or 15 or 20 years after this, but what always is curious for us, or what we always wonder about, is why does it just end right here? Why doesn't he say, and after 2 years, he doesn't really even say that after 2 years, Paul was released. Which if he knows that he was there for 2 years, he could have told something about what happens after that. And we can talk about that in a moment. There's some passages that we'll go to. But the short of it is that that's ultimately not Luke's point. His point, I think the big point all throughout Luke, all the way into the book of Romans all into the book of Acts, is it's not so much a focus on Paul or what happens in his life, or Peter and what happens in his life, because we don't really know what happens to Peter after a certain point in the book of Acts, or what happens to some of the other apostles after a certain point. The focus the whole time is on Jesus Christ, and then subsequent to that, the gospel about Jesus Christ that spread really through the work of the Spirit, who you could maybe even say is the main character in the book of Acts. Once Luke gets to the ultimate point of the gospel has even reached the farthest, has reached far from Israel and into the heart of the Gentile Empire in the capital of Rome. In many respects, his story, his account, that's a very good ending place for that, because if he can go from Jerusalem to Rome in less than a generation, where can it go from there? So we don't know when Luke actually finishes writing this account. I imagine, again, that he could have added more to this, but I don't think that's part of his point. But he ultimately ends on this note with Paul, which, again, having just come fresh off the letter to Romans, we can understand where Paul is coming from here, because he deals with okay, we have Gentiles and we have Jews who become a new people in Israel. But he spends a lot of time in Romans 9 through 11, if you remember, lamenting the fact that many Israelites have not responded to the gospel. And you see that playing out even when he ultimately comes to Rome in Acts chapter 28, where in verse 17, he gets together the leaders of the Jews from the different synagogues in the area. And it says that some seem to heed him and some don't listen. But ultimately, it says after 25, disagreeing among themselves, they departed after Paul had made one statement. So Paul kind of drops a passage from Isaiah, which kind of really is a conversation ender. When he says that you have ears but aren't going to hear, eyes that aren't going to see. Paul obviously knew, okay, at this point, this is, I assume very well, I trust Paul knew, okay, this is the time to drop this. And that kind of ended that there for the Jews that weren't going to follow after him. And I think the assumption is that at the same time that some of them had listened. And ultimately would be persuaded. And all this is happening. Remember, there also is a church in Rome as well, made up of Jews and Gentiles. And I imagine the 2 years that he spends in Rome, he talks about in verse 30, are 2 years that he spends working with that church, but also trying to reach out to those Jews that are outside of it as well. Are there other thoughts or comments on this, or especially as it relates to the book of Romans, just anything in general? Don?
I'm always encouraged in places like in verse 15, when Paul saw the brothers that had come to basically meet him and then go into Rome with him. He thanked God and took courage. It reminds me that this is a human being, and
yeah.
He has the same ups and downs that we all have.
Yeah.
And God has, I think God sent those brothers to give him courage.
Yeah, good point.
I also think the same things, John, wrote to these many miracles we could record all of. But this was enough that you believed.
Yeah.
And it would be the same here.
Yeah.
This isn't all of it.
Yeah.
There's no telling how long Luke could have continued writing.
Yeah.
The exploits, everything. This would be enough that you should believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, other thoughts.
Yeah, that, you know, at the beginning. When he gave the great commission at the beginning of the book of Acts, you know, he says you should be witnesses to me in Jerusalem, all Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And so that's the story that we get here. But you know, it's also often seen to me that Theophilus or whoever is being addressed as, you know, is most could very well be in Rome. And so what we're getting is that. What you're getting in Acts is the story ultimately of how the gospel comes to Rome.
Yeah.
You know, with the understanding that other apostles are, you know, the gospel's going out in all directions.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing here is almost just one.
Yeah.
But it is going south to Egypt. It's going east into Persia, even into India. It's, you know, north up into Turkey.
Yeah.
So all the apostles were working. Because so much of what we have written is focused on Paul's letters and Paul's journey west here.
Yeah,
it certainly does gather the bulk of the attention. You know? But it does the same thing.
And to that point, I think I might have written some of this out the other day, and even a question that afterward Carrie had asked, it prompted me to look at some things as well. But first of all, just things that, okay, the book of Acts, it records the gospel coming this path to Rome. In Paul's missionary journeys, prior to Paul's missionary journeys, we see the gospel roughly here with people like Philip and Peter and on and on and on. Then with Paul and Barnabas, we see the gospel spread to about here on the map. Later in a second missionary journey, the big place that the gospel comes on a second missionary journey is over in this area. The third missionary journey, that's going to be more in that area because that's where Ephesus is. And then after the third missionary journey, it comes over there. So that's only a small part of this overall Mediterranean map. We know, aside from that, just traditional, Paul himself alludes to the fact that he might have, we read it in the book of Romans, the province that he mentions a little far back goes up roughly about as far as there. If Paul was indicating definitively that I did go to that province and preach there, then we have things that aren't mentioned in the book of Acts that are happening as well. We know just historically, not just from traditions, but I mean archaeology, other things like that, we can trace, and just other people writing about it, we can see that the gospel, I mean, you talk about the Ethiopian eunuch. I mean, the gospel coming down here earlier in the book of Acts. We know that roughly by the 200s, the gospel had come over through that northern part of Africa. The gospel from other places by the 200s had gone up from there and into other places, ultimately into Spain also. Acts is, I mean, and even East as well. Acts is only recording, again, a certain part. It can't, like Mark said, it can't record every possible thing. That's one thing to always keep in mind. To Don's point as well, one of the things I just wanted to just piggyback on there, this is how she mentioned that Paul thanked God and took courage, and that God, and I agree with her, God sent those people to him to so that he could take courage from that. And this is how God works over and over and over. Sometimes we might pray to God for help in this or help in that. And often, and usually always, how God works is through other people, through people created that he created in his image. And this is how God over and over works in the world. Jesus, he ascends into heaven. And I've always wondered myself, like, why doesn't he stick around? And I think the answer in that is because once Jesus ascends into heaven and sends his spirit out into the world, it's not just him working, but it's all people who are called by Christ's name. It's not just one, it's many people who are like Christ and acting like Christ in the world. God works through his people. Let's go to the book of Luke real quick. Luke chapter 1. So let's make a few applications before we close out. And Luke chapter 1. And were there other thoughts or comments on any of that? Okay. Luke chapter 1. And this kind of... Carl went back to the very beginning of Acts to talk about part of Luke's purpose. And I think Luke 1, which is really the beginning of these two volumes that Luke writes, gives us an indication of why Luke goes in the direction he does. If someone would read Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, please.
Inasmuch as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered to us, it seemed good to me also, having had a perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed.
So really the phrase that stuck out to me, as I was coming to a conclusion in Acts and just went back to the beginning of Luke, Luke details his purpose in the very beginning, that first verse, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us. That's really Luke's purpose all the way from the gospel to the book of Acts, to show the things that had been accomplished through us. Sometimes it was through Peter. Sometimes it was through Paul or Barnabas or Philip or Stephen. But every single time it's through the word of God. It's through his spirit. It's through Jesus who sends out the spirit of God. or who ascends into heaven and the Spirit comes in his absence. It's both Luke and Acts, and especially Acts, it's not so much about individual people or an individual person as much as the God who's working through these people and the Word of God working through them, which again, I think is an answer to why Acts, part of the reason why it ends when it does. And to Carl's point, if Theophilus is someone in Rome, it's a big show of what actually has been accomplished through us. It doesn't have to go into the details of everything that happens later. Other thoughts, we'll move to another application. Let's go to, let's go to Mark chapter 16. Mark 16, I alluded to this, let's just read it in full. Mark 16. Mark 16, would someone please read verses, someone just read verses 14 through 18.
Afterward, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were reclining at the table, and he reproached them for their unbelief and hardness of heart, because they had not believed those who had seen him after he had risen. And he said to them, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation." Through 17?
Through 18, please. 18.
He who has believed and been baptized shall be saved. But he who has disbelieved shall be condemned. These signs will accompany those who have believed. In my name they will cast out demons, and they will speak with new tongues. They will pick up serpents, and they will drink any deadly poison. It will not hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover.
So the book of Acts, just as a whole, it shows all of these things happening. In terms of those who believe are people that are baptized, and those who are baptized are those who are saved. And these signs accompany those who believe, the miracles, the healing. Specifically in Acts chapter 28, we see those two of those things specifically, the healing through hands and also the serpents. Now, obviously, in our day, I think there's still something that we can draw from this, that even in our day when we might not see these signs or these same exact things in Mark chapter 16, I think there's a deeper point there that God, when we go out into the world and do the work that we're called to do, that God is still with us. He aids us. He helps us, obviously in ways that we would never be able to put our finger on completely, but there's a certain comfort. And throughout the book of Acts, you see even Paul, who is in prison and in chains, God is still working through him in those circumstances. And God does the same for us. The important thing is that we listen to that Great Commission and are obeying it ourselves in our lives. Other thoughts or comments?
When you consider the timing, Christ sends his apostles out on the Great Commission. Depending on which calendar, which one you listen to, Passover is, or Pentecost is 50 days after Passover. Some say 40 something, whatever, that time period. So you see the issuing of Christ's commands, and then you get to Acts 2, starting when you start the first part, but 36. 47, you see that commission in action. You have those speaking in tongues. You have those hearing the word, receiving the word, being baptized, added to the church. So it's like people say, well, this here's what he said, and this is what happened just a short period, within 6 weeks at the most. Here it is in action. And then we see it through the next. And the next conversion. So how do you then say belief is necessary, but baptism isn't? They're both the same in the equation.
Yeah.
If you can leave faith, leave baptism, then you can leave faith and still be saved. They all know about this. That's what it says.
Yeah. Other thoughts? Let's go one more passage as well that relates to what we read in Acts chapter 20. This is the book of Philippians. Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1. I'll read verses 12 through 14 in the letter to the Philippians. Paul writes, and Paul's writing also from prison, and very, very likely, or very possibly, the prison in Rome. He says, chapter 1, verse 12, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. So this is a famous passage in Philippians where Paul, I'm assuming that this is the same imprisonment as you have in Acts chapter 27 and 28. And even if it wasn't, I still think Paul would have the exact same attitude. Paul didn't write in Romans that, hey, I'm gonna come to you guys and I'm gonna be locked up in jail when I come to you. Because he doesn't know, as far as we can tell, he doesn't know that that's exactly going to happen. He's actually going to get a prophecy about it when he gets to Jerusalem, that this is what's going to happen, but that's prior to him, that's after him writing the letter to the Romans. But God uses his chains as an opportunity. And so even in the difficult things that we go through, and we made this point last week as well on Sunday, just like with the Joseph story, God uses our bad situations. Not only does he help us in the situations, but he uses those situations for us to benefit and help others. That doesn't mean that we should pray for misery from God, but it does mean that when we face trials and we face difficulties, we should always keep our eyes open to what can I still be doing in service to God. And even after the fact, maybe have some awareness of, yeah, I don't want to ever go through exactly what I did then, but there are certain things that I learned. There are certain ways that opportunity helped other people. And Paul recognizes it right then, that if he were not in prison, he wouldn't have had an opportunity, first of all, to preach the gospel to the guard that he was under guard from. And also, in addition to that, if he hadn't been imprisoned, other brothers and sisters wouldn't have been able to be as encouraged and take courage from the fact that, hey, Paul's in jail and he's still able to do the work of the Lord. Paul's in jail and God is still with him. Maybe I shouldn't be afraid myself about what man can do to me. Thoughts or comments?
Well, and I think you have reference that the gospel reaches even the household of Caesar. In the time there when he said, well, he mentions it in one of the prison epistles.
Yeah.
So it almost makes Paul more of a celebrity in Rome. He's there, he's under house arrest, probably very unusual circumstances.
Yeah.
To be waiting for his audience. Audience with Caesar, so technically he's under arrest, but he enjoys a certain amount of notoriety. It is interesting that as determined as the Jews were to kill him, that they hadn't gotten word.
Yeah.
To Rome by the time Paul got there.
Yeah, and on that point, I mean, we'll conclude on that. The Book of Acts just says that he spent 2 years in Rome. We don't know exactly what happened after that. We don't even know if he got his audience with Caesar. It's also possible that if his accusers never showed up in Rome, It's possible that something like that could have just been dismissed by default. Whether he stood before Caesar or not, it's assumed that he was released at that point. And that's when he wrote the letters to Timothy and Titus. Eventually, he'd be back in Rome. He'd be executed then. But with that, we'll close out the class on Romans and